Hey, y'all. You're listening to the Coochie Business Podcast, where we talk about coochies in general and Black coochies in particular. I'm your host, Dr. Abigail, an Afro-queer woman working on my fifth degree focused on the natural Black coochie. And as your coochie curator, I'm here to bring you dope stories and conversations that'll make you laugh and sometimes cry, but will always give you something to think about. And today's episode definitely will. Now, this episode is long and deep, but it's lively and full of stories and resources for you to go digging around if you want to. When God was a Black woman and why she isn't now. So I'm talking to Joseph Gibson today. I asked him to be on this podcast because of that book. But like I said, it's long. We African, we storytellers, and you know how that be sometimes. So let me just tell you a little bit about him, and the rest will tell itself. Mr. Gibson is an internationally recognized author, an independent publisher, and a dedicated urban educator. He wrote his first major title and established a publishing company, Kitabu Publishing, while he was an undergraduate student. And then he began this extensive career in urban education. Most recently, he's worked as an administrator in several high poverty and high minority Michigan schools focused on research-based turnaround strategies. And yeah, Mr. Gibson is a teacher or principal administrator, but Mr. Gibson writes books, y'all. Check out Kitabu Publishing for real. It's mind-blowing. He's written about everything from the origins and impact of slave Christianity on Black people to racism and neuroplasticity and how racism changed the brain and to the lack of protecting Black life in America. I mean, he's also written books on various education-related themes. But whatever. We're here to talk about when God was a Black woman and why she isn't now. So let's get into this. Hi, Joe. Thank you for being on this podcast with me. I'm so grateful for your time today.
I'm honored to be here. Thank you for reaching out. Very unexpected. Appreciate it, though.
I appreciate your response. It was, I hadn't even launched the podcast when I sent that email. I've been visioning, and it's interesting, and I'll share the story of how I found your book, and it was the title that blew me away. But I was in San Diego and had an acquaintance tell me about a book about When God Was a Woman. And I was looking for that book after being, you know, moved and I guess confirmations of things that I've had innately. And I ordered the book. As I was waiting for the book to arrive, I was like, let me find an advanced copy, one of those sneak peek things, so I can read it. And as I was looking for, you know, maybe a PDF copy or something, I saw what I believe was your abstract for your book. And it was, first of all, the title, When God Was a Black Woman and Why She Isn't Now, but also why you wrote it. And you talked about white lies, lies of omission, if you will, and how they're more dangerous. And it blew me away. And I attempted to find, this was 2014. So I wanted to order that book and I could not find a copy of it. The only copy I could find at that time was like $500 or $800.
Which is crazy because I don't see any of that money, by the way.
And somewhere in Australia or somewhere, the intensity of how I was like, I need this book right now. I cannot. Eventually, I found and that's the first copy. I have an actual physical book right now, but I eventually found like a CD-ROM or some CD copy of it. And that's what I ordered after hours of searching at some remote website. And it was not Kitabu Publishing because I just found that this year. But anyway, I'm grateful to have you because that book, I've told so many people about it. It was one of the blatant and overt, you know, connecting of dots that I've read, right? That confirmed things that were innate for me. So, but yeah, years later, here I am. Before I launched the podcast a few weeks ago, I sent you a cold email. What was that like for you when you received it?
Well, anytime I get any kind of feedback, any kind of, you know, response from a book, it's always unexpected. It's appreciated. You know, that book is, I think I wrote that maybe 10 years ago. So, you know, to get a response to it as strong as your response. It was, I was shocked, surprised, appreciative. Felt really good. Like, it felt good to know that the impact that I envisioned when I created the book seemed to have, you know, manifested. So.
Mm-hmm. And what about the coochie business part?
It was cool. I don't have a problem with it at all. I mean, despite the beard, you know, I'm only 43 years old. No, 44, just turned 44. So, you know, coochie is part of my vernacular growing up and being a young person. And it was cool. I thought it was creative as hell.
Perfect. Thank you. So since we're talking about coochie, one of these questionnaires that I don't necessarily make it onto the podcast per se, but maybe on the blog later on, I'll ask invited guests, what's your favorite word for coochie, or what's the word you use? And you responded, what is some? I've never heard that. Where did that come from?
Okay. So I thought about that question. Like, that question took me the longest out of all the questions combined. Cause I don't talk about that. I just don't never talk about it. Like, I don't ever say it. I never articulate it. I never verbalize it. Like, even right now, I'm not verbalizing it. I'm just referring to it. I'm inferring it. I'm implying it. I'm insinuating. And I've always done that my whole life. I've never used the word pussy or coochie or none of that. Like, even that, to me, when I said it just then, I was like, oh man, you know, maybe I shouldn't have said it like that. But, and I wanted to know why. Like, I wanted to know why, right? And then I thought about people I grew up with and my family, and particularly like male relatives and people I hung out with, like my peers and friends, and they use, you know, all kind of slang terms and, you know, some of the wildest stuff, you know, that I'm pretty sure you've collected over your lifespan, and you know most of these terms, right? And they use them freely, you know, without any second thought. And I don't know why. And I'm not trying to say that I'm special or particularly moral or, you know, the moral superiority in this. It has nothing to do with me being a writer or nothing. I don't think it has anything to do with that. I think it has more to just some kind of way. Early in my life, I had a profound respect for black, because, you know, I've only been with black women. So, and I don't say that as a negative at all. You know, that's my preference by far. And I appreciate you guys, obviously beyond just, you know, sexually, but sexually, my appreciation, it's indescribable. I can't put it into words. So because of that, I don't think I use the term. Like, I don't have a term. So it's always inferred. So, for example, can I have some? Can you give me some? When are you going to give me some? It's always inferred. It's always implied. I don't speak directly to it at all. And I've never done it. Like, even as a teenager, I wasn't going around saying, give me some pussy, give me some pussy. No, I just didn't. And, you know, that's me.
I get it now. I was like, some? I've never heard of it. Give me some. I get it.
So I cheated. I didn't really answer your question. I cheated.
No, you did. No, it's perfect. And you even answered it. You elaborated on your answer. So I'm glad it did come onto the podcast, because one of the things, so it's interesting to me, the connection here, right? So I read your book, When God Was a Black Woman and Why She Isn't Now. And my connection to that is there's something powerful in women and their reproductive, because I'm a midwife and all of these other things. And I'm a black woman, right? But it was birth and life and that being my calling that opened my eyes early on, before I was even here, about the divinity in women. But I didn't necessarily always, yes, I did see it reflected back in me, but not necessarily by society. And so I've always been, wait a minute, we are powerful. So what is going on? But my issue was really with us. And that's why coochie business, like, we need to understand who we are and how powerful we are, and everything will come in alignment. Right. And so when I read this book, it was like, oh yes, because one of the simplest ways was, if life is divine, is, you know, remarkable, and women can, quote unquote, bear, give birth and give life. Surely, if we think about nature and what we can see and all these simple things that I would ask as a child, surely when we think about God, there's some woman in there as well. What's up with that? My father's a pastor. I grew up in the church. And so I saw all this, what I know now to be sexism and chauvinism and all these things, racism, all the, you know. Then I come to the U.S. I learn a lot about being Black and woman, but in America, though I'm not an American, right? So that was a whole other, you know, layer of learning that I wasn't necessarily getting in the home because of what it means to be an immigrant versus what it means to be young and going through schools. So the connections in here, as I approach your book and your approach to the book, as it relates to even the use or not, the naming or not, the reverence, though, in both camps, the reverence for Coochie, the reverence for Black women, for both of us. But for me, it's like, we got to talk about it. And for you, it's like, let's not say it. It's reverence. So for me, I really appreciate it because to respect the silence is also important, as well as interrogating the silence, which is what I want to do. We need to interrogate the silence. I believe we must be able to speak of a thing in order to heal it and do it and recognize it. But at the same time, the word itself doesn't necessarily matter. Names are important, naming practices, especially as African people, right? Yes. But the name itself isn't. And this is why we have stories and so many different names for the same thing. So we can't get stuck on the name, right? So some is perfect. And honoring the silence while making sure that that recognition is there in the silence. That's the key thing. So I really appreciate that in your introduction with your word for Coochie.
You know, it also makes me think about a song, a rap song from Common. I don't remember the name of the song, but in it, he talks about the value of naming things. So, he's talking about his girlfriend at the time, and he talks about how, you know, I don't want to call you my boo. I don't want to call you my bitch. I don't want to call you these things because there's power in what I call you. And that version of that little part of the song I thought about when I was looking at the question. Because, you know, I'm a hip hop head. I'm a hip hop junkie. So I like to relate to songs when I think about stuff. And then that little part of the song, I think the song might have been called Pimp, but I'm not sure. But it made me think about it. Like, yeah, it's important that, you know, what we call things. And I've seen the word pussy referred to Black women in a way similar to the word nigga. Like with malicious intent, with aggressiveness, with hostility. I've seen it used repeatedly in that way. Early on as a child throughout growing up. I didn't want to imitate that. I didn't want to repeat that.
Yeah. I can appreciate that, especially, you know, not being a Coochie owner and having that reverence for Coochies, to put it in those terms, right?
Right.
And this is where naming is beneficial and harmful, can be either, but how do we reclaim? Just like nigga and just like pussy, they've both been reclaimed and they both continue to be harmful, right? So when and where and how, these are all the questions I have, and there's lots of different names. I do believe whatever the case, we got to talk about it, especially from within our own communities. Okay, well, so another thing that was a connection for me is how you came to write this book, both your interaction with the first book, Stone's book, and what made you, and your teaching, and your scholarship, your passion for education in urban communities, urban youth in particular. So share some stories about how that all happened.
Well, I want to say maybe in 2002. No. 2005, 2006, probably 2006. I was a world history teacher, high school world history teacher at the time in Atlanta, Georgia. Somehow, I don't remember how, but I came across the concept of mitochondrial Eve. In I think I was teaching maybe AP World History, Advanced Placement World History. And it just blew my mind, like the concept of it just, wow, that makes a lot of sense to me. Why don't we talk about this? Is this missing from the world history book? And so I started doing my research about this mitochondrial Eve. It all started with that concept. And
real quick, what is the mitochondrial Eve for people who are wondering?
So basically, it's just I don't want to say the theory, but I'll say theory just for lack of a better word. The theory that all human life originates from Africa, from a single source, a single female, African female, and genetically that's been proven. And as far as the most modern version of humanity, that person, that African woman who birthed the modern version of humanity has been termed mitochondrial Eve because our genetic makeup comes from her. So whether you're European, Asian, whatever, there's a way to look at your DNA and trace it back to this African woman. So she becomes the mother of modern humanity.
Yeah, and I'm sure a number of people who are listening to this would not have. So thanks for explaining that. So you hear about the mitochondrial Eve and you're teaching in Atlanta. What happens?
So I said, okay, I got to do something with this, right? So back then, I was really into debates, and I would stage debates in my class, and I kind of taught through debates. And my kids hated it at the time, even though now, as they're grown, most of them are very vocal and outspoken. And I like to think that might have something to do with me. But so I framed a debate and basically said, should the United Nations celebrate, create a global holiday to celebrate mitochondrial Eve, right? Ended one of the first debates, and I had some really bright kids. So they would go and take debates places I just wouldn't imagine them going. But there was like, how do I say this? So I would set up my kids as far as their debate argument. So I would say, okay, what would you most likely want to debate? What side would you most likely want to debate? And I would assign you the opposite side on purpose. So in that particular debate, I grouped kind of girl, boy. So it had boy teams, girl teams. And of course I gave the girls we shouldn't have this holiday, and the boys, yes, we should have this holiday. And this is urban Atlanta, 2006, public high school. And the girls, and these are almost all African-American females, were able to basically argue against the holiday by demeaning black womanhood. And they took modern problems or modern dilemmas, right? And use it against celebrate mitochondrial Eve. So for example, again, part of it was stuff that we had talked about in class that they just used. So we looked at the black abortion rate, right? Disproportionately high. They used that. One group used that argument and said, well, how can we celebrate life if we also destroy life at such a high rate? And this is directly related to being a black woman. I mean, I think this had to be like 2006. This had to be 2006, maybe even 2007. Because I had trained this group of kids in debate the year before. I had them in one class, and then I had the same kids the next year. So they knew how to debate by then. So I'm listening to their arguments, right, and how they were able to just attack black womanhood as black women. And I said, well, this isn't good. I got to figure this thing out, right? So I've always been a reflective teacher, so a reflective principal too. I've always reflected on that day or whatever happened to try to figure out how to make it better. So I looked at what they said about mitochondrial Eve and how they related it to their image, their current self-image, their current self-concept. And I said, okay, how can I help them understand what they're doing, one, and then maybe start the process of healing that or fixing that. but I didn't have enough information at the time. So it just kind of sat with me, right? Then, I don't know, maybe a month later, I came across the book When God Was a Woman, right? And I don't remember exactly how I came across it, even though I probably spoke to it in the book, in my book, but I don't remember outside how I found it. I feel like I might have found it in an old bookstore in Detroit that I would just go in and hunt for books. And I think I just came across it, to be honest with you. I think that book found me.
It did. Just like your book found me.
Yeah, thank you. So I read it, and I had read it, like I said, it was like a month after we had this debate, right? So we were just getting into, in the history class, we were getting into slavery, right? And I was looking at slave Christianity, how Christianity was used in America during slavery to basically quell the rebellious spirit of the enslaved Africans in America. And I knew that I wanted to do a lesson on that, but I didn't want to do like the normal lesson. I didn't want it to be like a debate, basically. I wanted it to be some type of project. So I read When God Was a Woman, and I got it. Like, I understood what she was trying to say. I appreciated what she was saying. I understood it. I understood the history behind it. I understood the archaeology behind it. Just being a trained, like, I'm a social studies teacher. I'm a certified social studies teacher. So all my training and all that was in that. So I get it. I understood it. It wasn't above my head. But I've always liked to take complicated text and figure it out, a way to break it down. So if I want to teach a lesson on it, I can teach a lesson and explain it to kids who, you know, were not necessarily that advanced intellectually. So, and I'm sorry if I ramble. I'm sorry if I ramble.
Oh, no, this is good. It's stories. That's what this is. We telling stories. That's how it sticks.
Okay. So I took that book. And I processed it. I read it because it's not a long book. It might be 200 some pages. So I read it kind of like over a couple of days, right? And I got it. I understood it. I said, okay, what can I do with this? Well, decided to basically sit on it for a whole year, right? So I didn't do the lesson that I thought I was going to do. I just sat on it. The next year, though, I had a plan. So my plan was, I'm going to teach these same group of kids about ancient black civilizations and how those civilizations don't get recognized as black. Like, I knew I was going to do that lesson because I had done that lesson before. And I was like, well, actually, it was a different group of kids then. So I did the same class, different group of kids, and I wanted to do that lesson, but flip it. So I was like, okay, instead of me doing this, the normal problem-based lesson of ancient black civilizations, why aren't they recognized as the first civilizations in the world? So looking at, you know, Sumer and Nile Valley and all those places that are right in Africa, why aren't they recognized as African? And then promote it, right? So I had already knew about Stolen Legacy, the book Stolen Legacy from George G.M. James, right? And in Stolen Legacy, just for anybody who don't already know, Stolen Legacy basically says that the Greeks came in the ancient Egypt, basically led by Alexander the Great, and along with the Greek philosophers at the time, Aristotle and them, they basically learned everything they knew in ancient Egypt, claimed it as their own, destroyed ancient Egypt, and then now they're getting credit for it. And that's basically the root of modern racism, is how we look at, why we negatively look at black people as being less intelligent than white people is always, it's kind of rooted in the fact that white people can claim Greece as the birthplace of civilization, even though that's not accurate, right? So, and I've had actually done lessons on that with my students, right? So they kind of knew that too. And I just want you to say, I just want you to know, some of the white staff at that school did not appreciate these lessons.
You know what, I want you to know, when you talked about these debates, I had teachers like you in high school, and I'm so grateful.
Thank you. I got in a little bit of slack, some heat every now and then. I just had to be real. I learned how to disguise stuff, respond and rationalize. So, okay, so basically that next year, so this would have been like 2007. And the timeline is important. So 2007, fall of 2007, I come up with this idea of, okay, in World History, AP World History class, I'm going to give this, and I had all my students in the AP World History class, by the way. So, like, it wasn't like a select group. Everybody who took World History pretty much had AP World History. I just, you know, why not? So, and it was a small school, too. So, basically, I gave them a lesson where they had to create a sermon celebrating, and this was set in, like, if they were in ancient times. So they had to come up with a sermon to celebrate an image of God as a female, as a black female, like straight up. It was the book, but before the book was made, right? So they had to create a sermon celebrating God as a black woman, in as if they were in ancient times, right? And I don't know if any of them will ever hear this podcast, but if they do, they may remember it and chuckle because it was funny, right? So part of it was they had to imitate a mega preacher, like the style of a mega church preacher, you know? So this is in Atlanta when, like, there was Creflo, a lot of big time black mega preachers. So they had to really get into this sermon, right?
So performance,
right, it was a performance, but it was factual. So they had to basically say, like, they had to identify God, who they wanted to accept as God. So whether it was ISIS or some other interpretation, they had to recognize them by name, and then basically give the reasons in the sermon why they worship this image of God as a black woman.
Yes.
And it was fascinating. I got in a lot of trouble from some parents because the student went home. Hey, what you working on? Oh, well, I got this assignment from Mr. Gibson where basically I had to give a sermon on God as a black woman. And these are all black people, by the way, pretty much. So I got some angry grandma calls, you know, why are you being anti-Jesus? Which was cool. You know, I was able to explain it. I had a couple of meetings. It was okay. I've always been about 300 pounds, 6'2". So I can kind of get away with stuff without saying a lot.
I cannot.
But
yes.
But I tried to explain it. And so, okay. So I took that lesson, right? And the kids struggled with that lesson. Like, the dramatics of it, the performance of it, they were profound. But content-wise, it wasn't enough information out there for them to take, interpret on their own, and then re-present, you know, as a project. It just, you know, when you, even though back then, you know, the internet was kind of not, it wasn't nearly as developed as it is now. It was nothing on, you know, you could not Google God as a black woman and find something. It didn't exist. Yeah. The concept of God as a black man existed. And there was a lot of like Islam, like Nation of Islam stuff, which I was familiar with. And that Nation of Islam stuff was kind of important too. Because when I was in college, I went to Grambling State. And when I was in college, I was introduced to the 5% Nation. And a lot of the stuff that I just didn't accept, I didn't buy into. But one thing that always kind of left an impression on me was, you are God. God is in you. And if you believe that, you'll act differently. You'll have a different level of self-respect. You'll have a different level of responsibility. You wouldn't be as destructive. Right? So all of this is in my mind. All of this is kind of coagulating and coming together in my mind, right? So, and on top of that, I'm losing kids, particularly black females. I'm losing kids to pregnancy. You know, I'm looking at how they talk and interact and dress. You know, I'm watching these things. I'm like, you know, what, something isn't right. Like something is off in the culture. Like our kids are just in a bad, going in the bad direction. And I just felt like maybe it was connected to how they looked at God. Another big influence on me was Francis Cress Wilson and the ISIS papers. Mm. And in that, you know, and I know probably everybody read the ISIS papers, but in that, she talks about the white God and how it affects black people, how our perception of white God affects black people. So I just looked at it on the next level. So if I had these black female students who are worshiping a black male, a white male God image, how messed up, how much damage must be going on, you know, so they're getting the double damage. So they're getting the male damage and the female, the race damage. And maybe this has something to do with it. You know, so that's in the back of my mind. So it's a lot of different things, a lot of thoughts, a lot of things I read, a lot of things I observed, some things I've taught, you know, that were kind of just sitting in my mind, you know, kind of just sitting in my mind, like maybe there's a connection here. And pretty much all my books, they come about because I'm looking at a problem that I don't understand and I'm trying to understand it better. So pretty much all my books are problem based. And with God, when God was a black woman, the problem was I had these young black females that I'm trying to educate. A lot of them have father hunger. A lot of them, you know, father didn't abandon them. Mother might have been young when she had them, so she's not quite prepared to adequately mother. In addition to the media, because back then, like hip hop, for example, like hip hop had a direct, it was like a full-fledged assault against black women, like just the way they were interpreted. So like the video vixen, this was the video vixen age. Like this was the beginnings, I believe, of the video vixen, when like every black woman in the video was shaking her butt and half naked. And it was the only image you saw. Back then, I don't think there was any
butt cheek, booty butt cheek. I was doing the Aaron Magruder. Never mind.
Did you reference the Boondocks?
Never mind.
I did.
I heard the Magruder.
Yes, I did.
What did you say? Because I just heard.
I love booty butt cheek, booty butt cheek. He always had, you know.
Believe it or not, I would show episodes of the Boondocks in class, and we would break it down. Okay. Like we would analyze it. This was in high school. This wasn't in college. So all these things are just kind of in my mind, right? And I'm looking at the problem, trying to figure out a way, like if, so like there was a book, there's always a book that seems to help people get through certain things. So I wanted to figure out a way to create that book to help these young black women get through what I was seeing, all the things that were attacking them at once that they might have not understood, right? So I'm looking at the modern stuff, and I want to look back historically, where did it all come from? Where did it all start? You know, and I want to go for as far back as possible. So that kind of led me to the idea behind the book.
Thank you for sharing that, because I like how you framed all of my books come from a problem, and this was the problem. This is what you were doing. This is where you were coming from. And this is what was in your mind. And you sat with it. You didn't jump to it. You let it percolate in your mind, and it's a beautiful manifestation. And years after reading it the first time, when I saw Kitabu published, I was like, of course, look at all these books, the titles. Amazing. We're going to link to Kitabu Publishing in the show notes. But yeah, people need to check you out for real. I'm curious, because one of the questions I had in the end for you is that book was published in 2008. We're in 2020. What have you seen since? What are your thoughts in terms of what's percolating in your mind? And are you in touch with any of your students, especially the Coochie owners, but also the non-Coochie owners, right? And how this has impacted them, if at all. And the reason I'm asking this question is because of the focus on the future, the intergenerational piece, right? This is targeted at youth. It carries on further in this way. And so I'm just curious what happens when young folks get this earlier and then they're in their 20s and 30s reflecting and on things.
I don't know. I am in contact with a lot of my students, you know, the Facebook, you know, a lot of them keep up with me on Facebook and I keep up with them. I do have a few students who I talk to on the phone, you know, even from way back then. So I know that even if it wasn't that particular lesson, and I don't know how many of them even know I write. So I definitely don't know if any of them know about that particular book. I didn't really promote myself. I didn't feel like that was appropriate. So I don't know if they read that book and said, oh, this had an impact. I wouldn't know. But I will say this, out of all the books I've written, it seemed like that book had, I get the most feedback, the most direct feedback from individuals from that book. So, and it's 95% females, black women, even a couple of old white women, reached out to me about that book, which was phenomenal. They were familiar with the original, Stone's book, Dr. Stone's book. And they were like, kind of like, you know, what made you do that? What made you, you know, write that book? Where did you know about this book? And I'm like, yes, I knew about the book. I talk about the book in my book.
Right.
But it was cool, though. But so I don't know. I would love to know. So I do know that, and I'm not trying to be arrogant in any kind of way. I say it as humbly as possible. I do feel like my students, when I was a teacher, because now I'm a principal, so I've been doing that for like the last 6-7 years. But when I taught, I feel like the way I taught changed my students forever, particularly how they looked at themselves and the responsibility they took for themselves based off of that change in their self-concept. My whole goal was to change the concept of young black people, the self-concept of young black people. That was the whole goal. That was the reason why I got into teaching. I read Miseducation of the Negro early in college. Some kind of way I read Pedagogy of the Oppressed about Paulo Freire early in college. And those two books said, okay, you're going to be a teacher. Some kind of way you're going to be an educator. So it was either going to be a college professor or a high school teacher. I knew I wanted to do one of those things because I could impact the self-concept of young black people. So I feel like I've done that. You know, the feedback I've gotten from former students, again, not necessarily directly addressing this book or that lesson, but just in general, I feel like I might have accomplished some of that.
I don't know if I know any of your students, but like I said, I've had teachers like you, and I know without being in touch with many of them, how things that they offered in class that confirmed things that were inside of me have helped steer me into where I am right now. And I'm probably going to reach out to a few of them after this. In your book, you wrote something about how an educator must, by definition, in these systems, essentially, be a revolutionary or an oppressor. And before you went into teaching, you knew upfront that you were going to be a revolutionary. And so even if I don't know your students or whatever, I do know the power of conscious thought and intention. You went in with that objective. And so let's get into some of this history stuff, right? Like what are some of the things that you unpacked in your book so that it's really clear to folks? Let me see. What you kind of alluded a bit to the eradication of this divine feminine. You know, we're talking about some things, but give some historical facts, figures, some references that we can link to so people can go and look into this themselves, because this is historical fact, not just theories. You know, you said a bit about the mitochondrial Eve, but what about the historical things, Greece, Rome, et cetera?
Well, it's a lot of history. So first off, I want to reference Dr. Stone's book, right? So Dr. Stone insinuated that it could have been some possible racism involved in how history was passed on. So, and we're talking about ancient history, right? So basically she kind of insinuated that maybe the history that we know about came about because of basically who won the battles, who won the most battles. So there was this armed conflict in a lot of ancient history where a certain group of people from the north came in and wanted to conquer the people of the south. And, you know, the people of the north are the Europeans who would go into North Asia, different parts of Asia, different parts of Africa, and take over those areas. And it might have been some racism involved. It was very ambiguous in how she presented it, right? And the and because she didn't quite say it, it made me say, okay, well, what are you not telling us here? So I don't know if I think I might have known about Sheikh Anta Diop, Dr. Diop from Senegal, already. But I don't know if I learned about him and did the research at the moment, or I might have already knew about him. But it referenced me back to the two cradle theory, his two cradle theory. So I'll explain it just for the audience. Basically, there's two cradles in ancient history of development, like the development of these civilizations. So the northern cradle is basically Europe. Or Northern Asia, so Eurasia, and then the Southern Cradle is Africa, and like other equatorial places. So in ancient history, the people from the North developed certain characteristics and tendencies that became part of their culture. One of those things was aggressiveness, xenophobia, the urge to conquer, to go to different places and conquer, the male deity, that concept came from that culture. Conversely, in the Southern Cradle, there was more, agricultural endeavors. So there wasn't a need to really roam and be nomadic and try to conquer other places. So there was no xenophobia. There was a lot of peace, a lot of spirituality, and they worship the goddess deity. And I say the goddess deity on purpose, because even with Dr. Diop, he didn't quite all the way commit to God, capital letter God, as a black woman. He more so said they promoted goddess worship. Lowercase g, which is a big difference. Even though it's closer to the concept, but it's not quite the same. So I looked at his work and I said, okay. And he also looked at how black civilizations, were taken over by people from the Northern Cradle. And he went into more detail. So I was able to kind of use some of his work and kind of process it in my mind. I said, okay. So I looked at some people that he referenced, other scholars in that area of antiquity and ancient history, and they were all pretty solid on, you know, Europeans came in, dominated, and in the process of dominating, they also changed the culture of these African people, Indian people, you know, that group, that early group of, you know, basically early civilization, that had been established for thousands and thousands of years before the people from the north people from Europe came and conquered it, they had already been established. Their culture was established. But it was conquered violently. Like there was like mass slaughters and as a result, you know, they imposed their cultural, their culture and their understandings of what is, divine, you know, as a result of them taking over militarily. So basically it kind of goes in the steps. So you got the people from the north, and I'm not trying to necessarily be like anti-white. This is just history. You could even look at Michael Bradley's The Iceman Inheritance, and he's white, and he breaks down this thing, you know, just straight up like, yeah, there was a lot of violence coming from ancient Europeans who were basically trying to find an area that was more hospitable and would promote their survival on a better level. And that's that Northern Africa, Northern Italy, those places, basically when they came further and further south towards the equator, they found those areas and they said, okay, this is what we want to take over. And because culturally those places wasn't necessarily as focused on being militarily developed, they were more peaceful and it was a vulnerability. So basically when Europeans came down, they were able to change culture. And that's when you see the shift from the divinity, the divine image being female to now all of a sudden being male. And you see the shift from the divinity or the deity image being black because it resembles the people to now resembling the invaders, the conquerors. And see, Dr. Stone in her book didn't mention any of that. So I had to figure out, okay, who conquered who? When did they conquer them? What happened as a result? What was the original deity? What became the deity? You know, and it was kind of heartbreaking as I was figuring it out. Cause I'm like, wow, this was devastating, you know? So, but I had never heard about it before. So, so breaking down kind of just, you know, once that conquest came in, and we're talking about, you know, 3000, 2000 BC, that kind of, that era, basically, that millennia, and it just continued on. So I believe in the book, I look at early ancient to kind of like the Egyptian civilization and the Greece, and then we kind of go from to the Moors to maybe a little bit about the Moors, and then focusing on now we got Africans in America and Christianity and the whole reasoning behind that.
Yeah, that is heartbreaking. Thanks. And it is a lot of history, and you do go through it in the book, Matt. I was trying to find a quote, because not only is it heartbreaking, it's also infuriating. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to find the quote that you mentioned in there about why you wrote it. Like, no, we must put this in there. You can't leave that part out, especially, I mean, to me, the most egregious thing was the person who studied, I guess, cultures and knew that deities look like the cultures that from which they come, and you're going to leave that part out.
Right.
That's very egregious.
Right.
And so, yes, heartbreaking to read about our history. Infuriating to see the omission of it, because it's a continuation of that same thing, right? And heartwarming, again, much gratitude and recognition for you taking it on in your ways and connecting those thoughts and leaving it for other people to pick it up. And that's part of that, talking about it. So for history, you've mentioned a few resources that people can interrogate. We can't get into all of that here, but there's a bit there to understand that there's racism and sexism that have been combined to eradicate, that have been removed from divinity. And at the very least, balancing it, reclaiming it, acknowledging that there has been an erasure.
I just want to say this too, if you don't mind. Can I jump in before I forget?
Of course, please.
So the reason, one of the most, and I mentioned this in the book, I explain it in the book, but if you're a conqueror, an oppressor, an enslaver, the easiest way to control rebellion is to figure out a way to degrade the women of the people that you're oppressing, enslaving, conquering, colonizing. Right? Because if the men of the conquered can't protect the women, even in societies where the women were involved in combat, maybe even led combat, there still was, you know, a majority male presence. Once a man feels like he can't protect his women, it changes something. It changes the level of respect for the woman, almost as a way of compensating. If I can't protect you, I got to devalue you. I mean, that's deep and terrible. If I can't protect you, then I must devalue you in order to make me feel better about not being able to protect you. Now it's not such a big deal. I mean, think about that. I'm not saying this is right. I'm just saying this is how the mind works. It creates defense mechanisms in situations where there's vulnerability. So I think early on, and it could have been by accident, it could have been intentional, but I think early on, these invading people realize that. They realize that if we can really target the women, we can probably stop a lot of their desire to rebel. So the value of women in cultures had a lot to do with the image of divinity in those cultures. So if you look at, you know, cultures that have the primary divinity, and that's what I focus on, the primary divinity, not lowercase g goddess, but God. We look at God as a woman. In those civilizations that looked at God as a woman, the value of women were way higher than in those cultures who looked at God as a man, regardless of the skin tone. Now, when you add skin tone, so now you're in civilizations that look at God as a black woman, God, uppercase G, as a black woman, then the status of the black woman in those societies were ridiculously higher than in societies who looked at God as a white man. So, like, there's a lot of talk now, like now in 2020, of black women being the lowest, on like the lowest status, like in America especially, but being looked at as like, you know, worse than like black men. So like being the most disadvantaged, the most targeted, the most attacked, the most assaulted. Well, I don't think it's coincidental that in this society, we look at God as a white man. So the polar opposite of the rank opposite would be black female. And as a result, there's devaluation. Now, it's not a coincidence that early in this country's history, and again, we can go back in ancient world history, but if you look at just American history, the very beginnings of this country, early on, they figured out we can't value the black woman as a human being. Economically, that won't work. And this is before breeding and slavery, and towards the end of slavery, in the beginning of slavery, they realized that there were certain disadvantages of looking at black people as fully human, because it wouldn't allow for the murders that came along with enslavement. It wouldn't allow for the enslavement itself. But there was a lot of things that black women were subjected to in slavery that early on the white people involved in that process knew that we would really have to push the white Jesus, the white God concept. We can't allow them to maintain, in those few African cultures who were able to maintain some type of their original pre-colonization, well, this isn't colonization, but some of their original goddess-related divinities, all that had to be destroyed because black women could not look at themselves as any part of the divine. Not in America, especially not in America. Now, this happened in other places too. Again, back to what I was saying about the military reason behind it, primarily. And I just think that's important. Like, I think it's important to understand, okay, in 2020, we're talking about the devaluation of black women. But that didn't just start. That has thousands of years of history behind it. That didn't start. Obviously, there's thousands of years that we're looking at world history. We're not looking at just American history that a lot of people would not know about. So I wanted to explain that. This is how we got to this point. And I tried to break down eras of world history, eras of American history, to talk about it and kind of show. It wasn't an accident. These things are all related, and it's important for us to know that.
It is. It's critically important to know these things and to connect the dots of time and history, you know, things that we could not possibly perceive in one or two or five generations. We have to connect those dots and bring it forward. And then you can see these larger patterns. Not only that, there's an embodied knowledge that's encoded, right? Yeah. And so one of the questions that I have is related to the fact that this is that persecution, that eradication, that erasure was very intentional and systematic and sustained over a long period of time. Mm-hmm. And so like Carter G. Woodson and Miseducation of the Negro and what it means to undo that, it takes work to undo that. And I mean, I'm bought in. I felt it in my bones and my blood before I even read the book. That was confirmation for me, but that's not always the case.
Right.
As you referenced in your high school classes, a lot of rejection will come from black women themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yes, yes.
Of course, from white men or oppressors who want to maintain whatever they put in, but even from the oppressed, as we can read in Black Skin, White Mask or Pedagogy of the Oppressed and how the psychology of the mind works, right?
Yep.
So my question, because this is so critical for all of our liberation, and this is why Coochie Business had to come out there and part of this, why this is the groundwork, framing theories about conversations that will be had. And putting it in bite-sized pieces or stories, ways that can slip in. But my question really is, what are your thoughts about how to navigate the rejection, the walls, especially from those, and I think all of humanity needs this knowledge because humanity is in a critical place right now. So this is for the liberation of all of us. But there are subgroups in here. What are some thoughts that you have in mind, either from experience, things that are coming to mind right now, about how to move through and get through to people? Of course, it's people's decisions, but how can we be more creative?
Well, I've worked with a lot of different types of people in education. Particularly as a school principal, I've worked with a lot of white teachers, right? And I've always worked in schools predominantly black with students, but we typically have a predominantly white teacher staff. So there'd be some difficult conversations because, you know, you could probably imagine how aggressive I would be in that position just from my writing. So there's certain things that I'm just not going to tolerate. For example, stereotype-based expectations of black students, right? So I've had those conversations with white people, and it was hard. Because for one, you know, there's groups of this population who benefit, understand they benefit, and don't want to stop benefiting from us being oppressed. They understand privilege, whether they call it white privilege or whatever, something else, whether they can articulate it or not, they understand that there's a benefit to black people being looked at on the lowest level. And that's just what it is with them. And that's not going to go away. Not with them. But there's different types of white people, just like there's different types of black people. Like, we're, you know, regardless of your skin color, there's no monolith here. So, you know, there are such things as white allies. Even before the phrase became popular this year, I understood the concept. Even with them, you know, they've been miseducated. They've been taught, like, if we just look at the focus of this book, right? So they've been taught their whole lives, God looks like this, right? So for me to try to say, hey, you know, historically, God looked like this, and it's totally different, that's going to take a lot of openness that just isn't a natural part of being a person. Like, your culture, you value your culture primarily because it's so consistent. You get your culture from generations of people who believe the same thing. So for someone like me to say, because nobody else is saying this, like, if they did, they said it afterwards. Part of my book writing process, I go on Amazon.com, well, at least since it's been invented, which has been pretty much my whole time as a writer. I go on Amazon.com, and I look for the book that I'm thinking about writing. And if I don't see it, I write it. If I see it, I don't write it. There's no book like mine that existed when I wrote my book. There's no book out there that says God is a black woman, uppercase G.
Right.
It didn't exist. God, now, ironically, Tupac said it in a song, which, again, I'm a hip-hop head. I think certain things just subconsciously sink in, and I give him credit. I quote him in the book. But, okay, so basically what I'm trying to say is you got generations of people who believe one thing, right? So whether you look at white people, whether you look at black people, and there's a lot of different types of black people. I mean, what are Africans on the continent being taught when it comes to religion? And I understand that concept. Like, I get it. I studied that. I mean, obviously you would know, but I know too. At least I believe I know. And I know that image is a white male image. And I know why, and I know when it started, and I believe this references the book. I know it's not an accident. I know it was a tactic. It was a strategy. It has a lot to do with colonialism. I mean, you know, like, I studied Steve Biko and people like that from the continent, or studied, I mean, there's so many people who break these things down. One thing I always want to do, and I try to do it when I write, is I give people credit for original thoughts. Some of these thoughts are not my original thoughts. I just like to put them together. So I might take what you said, if I could verify it and it makes sense to me, and now we can create something new from it. So I think that's important. So I'm not the first person saying, oh, our image of God is wrong. However, I could take these different thoughts and concepts and ideas and put them together and say, this is why, and this is the effect. And this is how we may stop it. So as far as teaching, getting people to change their image of the divine, I think it's slowly happening with the people who should start the process, which is black women, like the most targeted people. Like, I believe that, and I might be wrong, but your presence here and your dialogue with me tells me when black women see that title, however they see it, And I don't do a lot of promoting. So however you run across the book, it changes you. It's supposed to change you. You're not supposed to see that book and read it and be the same afterwards. That's not why I wrote it. And I figured if a black woman, regardless of age, but I really wanted to target younger black women, but if whoever black woman read that book, then they would tell some other black woman about their book, and eventually they'll tell a black man about that book and get that black man to stop treating them as less than. Right? Because a lot of the destruction of the black female is caused by black men. Whether it's physical, psychological, spiritual. Like, we do a lot of damage, but I think we do a lot of that damage because we're compensating for damage being done to us. I'm not excusing it. I'm just trying to understand it. So, like, because I know it, in my home, I have to do certain things differently than, like, a normal probably person would. As an educator, I taught black women differently, more intentional than some other educators would. Like, I made sure that certain women, black women's contribution in the advancement of the world was recognized and focused on when I taught. So if you had me, you learned about more black women than you will probably ever have learned about from anybody else. Why? Because you got to have counterfactuals. You have to have images that contradict what everybody else is pushing on you. Even on Sunday morning, right?
Yes, this is so interesting to me in a lot of different ways, because as a black woman, right, I'm hearing this. I'm going to say a few things here. I had a friend recently. I've been out of the loop for a while. I generally am anyway, but I've been for the last few years just being prepared for some of these things. But I haven't really marketed this in any kind of way. I just launched the platform because it's been with me for a while. But I did with a few people kind of say, hey, this is what I'm doing. And I had a friend reach out to me, a black man, 2 children, a daughter and a son, married to a woman, a black woman. And he said, hey, Abby, Coochie Business, you and another friend were doing something. I really wanted to promote it, but I couldn't. He just couldn't. Every time he says coochie, almost like your silence, where he says some, he's like, it's even when we text, he has all these, the symbols for different things. Like, it's a cuss word. It's coochie. I'm not even saying pussy. But anyway, in that conversation, and I'm going to have a separate conversation, episode about it. It made me, we had a lot of dialogue, and it was amazing, actually. But out of it, from questions he asked me, he was like, what's black men's role with coochie? Like, what that got to do with me? Essentially, right? For many reasons. If we say something, in fact, I recently, I don't watch a whole lot of TV, but I heard about a special episode on Black-ish where the girlfriends came in and they were talking about feminism or something. And that was really interesting because in there, watching that family deal with sexism, essentially, and racism, because feminism is kind of whitewashed. And I'm recently learning about womanism versus feminism. And I don't know enough to speak too much about it right now.
Yeah.
But lots of questions. But watching that Black-ish episode, it was really interesting to see how the directors, producers navigated this conversation within the different generations, within the different genders or sexes, mm-hmm. and within race.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that came up was watching, I forget the husband, the father name.
Right.
And his 2 sons try to teach them what they need to do. And when he finally got it at some point, he was like, oh, maybe sexism is to racism, right? So me as a man, a black man, I'm treating them in this way that white people treat us as black people.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
And white allies, they just never gonna get it.
Right.
And we try to do it and keep messing up and all of these things, or they try to do it. Or and the same thing applies as men. So that was interesting in general, because as my friend was asking me these questions, I was like, well, because in my mind, we need everyone to get it for this liberation, because the liberation of coochies in general, black coochies in particular, will be the liberation of all of humanity, is my working theory.
Yeah, right? But I think that I agree. I think that it might start, though, with having some Nat Turtles when it comes to the liberation of black women's vagina. I think that'll start it. And I can explain it if you want me to, but I think that's what will require. We'll need some people to.
But and I think that's why it was interesting to me, because you as a black man, mm-hmm. right? Or just like we say, some people will say, you need white people to help dismantle white supremacy. If we're gonna, I don't know if that's where you're going with it, right? But it was just interesting to hear and read and see and have this dialogue with a black man and the work that you're doing in planting these seeds in black women's minds, and the where the spaces and where the overlap is with role and responsibility and understanding and passing on of the torch. Understanding that we need all of these things to happen, but where do those conversations happen, right? Mm-hmm. Where do men speak with men? Where do we speak with each other?
Yeah.
Where do women speak with women? And what are the common conversations that are happening across all of those spaces?
Mm.
Tell me about Nat Turner. What did you mean by that?
So by Nat Turner, it's black women as Nat Turner, by the way. So it's not like, you know. So I think about like just the liberation of oppressed people throughout history, right? And a lot of our oppression, unfortunately, has been spearheaded by different groups of white people. Unfortunately, historically, right? So, like, I'm looking at, like, slavery as a specific type of oppression of a certain population of black people by a certain group of white people. And the only reason why, and people argue against this all the time, right? But one of the main reasons why abolitionism became a big thing, the Civil War became a possibility, a lot of the legislature of that time was shifted. It was because of what Nat Turner did. Now, Nat Turner was not by any means the only slave rebel, right? There was probably 200 or plus undocumented slave revolts in American history. But his had an impact that was very unique. It scared the hell out of white people because it showed the extremes we were willing to go. There's a movie
called... Tell a little bit about it. Maybe people don't
know. So basically, Nat Turner, which I would say watch the movie The Birth of a Nation, the new one, well, the fairly new one, even though there's some complications with the director and actor in that movie. The movie itself is a quality movie to understand Nat Turner, right? And I wanted to acknowledge that because I get it. But Nat Turner basically... He was a preacher, which is important. He was a slave. He was enslaved. He was commissioned to be a preacher, basically taught himself to read the Bible, learn in the Bible that the slavery thing wasn't supposed to be, and then eventually was inspired to take up arms and start an armed rebellion with a small group of black people in Virginia, with the goal of liberating all black people in America that were enslaved at the time. It would have worked, possibly. They were just outmanned and outgunned. But in the process, he killed anywhere between 50 to 75 white slave-owning families, members of slave-owning families, with his small group of rebels. He was caught. They were all caught. They were all executed, unfortunately. But in the process, it changed white America's image of black people. Before Nat Turner, it was very common for white people to accept the happy slave narrative, where slavery was a benefit to black people and we were okay with it. Because we're better off than being in Africa, and that's what they wanted to accept. after Nat Turner, there was a paranoia, a national paranoia, that there could be a Nat Turner in anybody's plantation, and you got to watch out. And it just shifted. So at the times, there were laws called slave codes that did different things to prevent rebellion amongst enslaved black people. Those were all elevated. So it went as far as, you know, there could be groups of black people meeting without white presence, white supervision. You couldn't sell guns to black people anymore, even to go hunting. There was a limitation on a lot of different things, all intended to prevent the next Nat Turner. And even in Virginia's, the state legislature of Virginia contemplated to just end slavery altogether right after Nat Turner. That's how afraid they were. They were like, if we just end slavery, then we wouldn't have to worry about any more Nat Turners. And there was other people who basically, you know, in that group kind of talked themselves out of it. Like, we're tripping. We need this money from these plantations. But the fact that it became a documented conversation showed the power. And so I look at this image of Nat Turner, right? And I say, okay, what if black women did the same thing? And I think about a movie by Spike Lee called Chi-Raq. It wasn't super popular, right? But in Chi-Raq, the lead character is a black woman tired of being mistreated by black men and just kind of the world in general. And she says, okay, ladies, we should basically go on strike and not give our coochie away until these black people, they were primarily focusing on like gang members in Chicago. They should, until they get their stuff together, we're on strike, no coochie for you. Right? And I thought it was cool, but it also was problematic because it limited the power of black women to that. And I'm like, well, what if you did so much more? So as a Nat Turner, I'm not necessarily talking about being like literal like Nat Turner and being violent per se, but what if more black women understood who they were, took it as a call to say, okay, we're going to spread this information. We're going to motivate people. We're going to inspire people with our actions and our words and our commitment to just knowing that how we're being treated is wrong. There's an alternative out there. There's a different way we could be looked at. And we should be looked at that way. And we're not going to stop until we be looked at this way. So it could start off with women like you who just have these conversations in a public space. And then it builds the momentum. And now we're looking at maybe TV shows and different kind of media platforms that with the same idea, though, the same message, the same trend of the reason why black women are looked at the way they are perceived the way they are, is intentional, unfortunate, but not necessarily invincible. Like, it could be changed. It could be improved. And if enough of you guys do that, it'll make black men change the way we interact with you because you won't tolerate certain things. Like, it's amazing the amount of things that you guys tolerate from us. And I'm just saying in general that harm you, but you continue to tolerate it because you don't understand, you don't value your own self-concept enough just because of misinformation, just because of the culture, just because of all these things that's consistently happened. You know, physical attacks, sexual attacks, the trauma of all that. You tolerate a lot of things that in tolerating perpetuate the destruction. It perpetuates the harm. So it might take some, like Nat Turner was enslaved, right? So arguably that's one of the highest levels of trauma you can experience. There's a lot of black women are disproportionately sexually assaulted. Black women are disproportionately raped throughout the world. It's not an American issue. It's a world issue, right? So if black women say, if you were sexually assaulted, now you're inspired by that traumatic act, just like Nat Turner was. And you go on and you say, that's not going to happen again, that we're going to do something to stop this from happening. Now, you might not necessarily go around cutting penises off, but you might use your words in a way. You might use your platform, your actions. You might create organizations in a way that has the same impact. It stops black men from, or whoever's doing the raping, from raping. You know, create laws, different levels of protection. Because some of this stuff is institutional. Create a different way of looking at sexual assault when it comes to black women. You know, black women, if they're sexually assaulted, they're not looked at the same way as white women who are sexually assaulted. It's all kind of justification and demonization used against black women where white women don't get that. Why is that? And how do we stop it? See, these are a lot of the work that needs to go on. And it might start with a conversation, but it becomes action. Well, now there's equal protection. You know what I mean? And there's equal valuation. But it starts with black women saying, I don't value myself enough. Why is that? How do I increase my self-value? Now, how do I spread that around to other black women? And then it's like a chain effect, inertia. It's one of them fancy words that basically you building up momentum to create change. Nat Turner to change the world. I believe black women can change the world starting with themselves. So it's not necessary for white women to look at you differently right now. It's not necessary for white men to look at you differently right now. It might not even be beneficial. It's not necessary for black men to look at you. You got to change how you look at yourself first. Then you can force everybody else to look at you differently. But if I look at you differently, you don't look at yourself differently, then I'm wasting time. If as a black man, I look at you one way positively, and you look at yourself negatively, then it does no nothing. But if you look at yourself positively, then it does everything. And maybe that's the Nat Turner logic.
Yeah. Now, I'm glad that you mentioned Nat Turner as a concept, not the penis of Nat Turner.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I was mentioning the friend that I was speaking to and how that conversation. We talked about a lot of things and it was a lot of questions and it was very rich, just like this one. And it was about in what space do you have these conversations? And he used the example of a strip club because, you know, it's like women empowerment, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or what do they call it? Hip-hop feminism, right? So you talked about the video vixens. That's kind of been turned on his head, kind of like nigga and pussy and reclaimed in some ways. But, okay, it might be empowering. It might be more dehumanizing or objectifying, right? Arguments on both sides. His perspective was, okay, fine. Let's say all the women, like you, Atlanta, Magic City. So you in a strip club. All the women on the stage are popping their coochies, making that money, but they're empowered, right? Fine. But let's say it's in a situation now with the men are pigs. Wolves. Let's say they're wolves coming in. All right, great. You're empowered. I'm still coming in to feast. So whose fault is it? Is it the empowerment? Are they right? Are the men wrong for just coming in because it's right there on display? That was an interesting perspective for me to think about as he brought that up and to ask that question. And for me, the answer is both. It's I think first and foremost, for the women to understand not just how we perceive ourselves. I think that's definitely first, but also how we're perceived,
mm-hmm.
right? And I don't know if this is what you meant when you said it may not be beneficial for people to see it differently in the beginning. There's a lot to consider and think about from within and from without, but how to do it from a place of power and empowered, an empowered place from within our communities. And that's the question that I'm most concerned about, and how to navigate the potential, maybe expected resistance that will come from it, and how to do it in creative ways.
Mm-hmm.
Creative in general, overt, like Nat Turner, and subtle, you know, like the spook who sat by the door and in these institutions and changing policies and, you know, code switching, because we need all of those things.
Mm-hmm.
But what's the strategy? And so I'm just grateful for the conversations, because it plants seeds in a lot of folks' minds about this. And for me, the priority is Black women and the younger Black women, because the minds, at least what I'm learning, and I'm curious your thoughts about this, about neuroplasticity and the widening age of adolescence and this second growth spurt. You know, for me, I was really interested in pre and perinatal psychology and birth psychology, but I'm even more interested, and my research will take me into adolescent psychology, or really biocultural adolescence, because I'm not a psychologist. I'm studying anthropology, which is in and of itself a problematic discipline, but we can interrogate it from within, which is what I'll be doing, right? And applying this biocultural lens to adolescence, and what can it mean? And that's why I asked you that question. How can we creatively and strategically put it in this? I'm thinking about culture, movies, graphic novels, coochie business, humor, things like that, just to keep planting the seed, because we need it everywhere and in a lot of different places and in a lot of different camps.
Yeah.
So neuroplasticity, adolescence, talk about some of the science of that or the research that you have come across with that.
So neuroplasticity is a phenomenal concept. I'm not trying to plug it, but I did write a book called When Racism Changed, or How Racism Changed the Human Brain. And that was my first kind of neuroplasticity related work. And since then, everything I talk about has something to do with the brain changing. I think it's important to understand that the brain can change at any age. It primarily changes. All right, let me rephrase that. It's easier to change something at an earlier age, because there's not a lot of things to contradict it, and there's just a lot more neurons going on at the time. But if you can make it emotional enough or repetitive enough, you can change your brain at any age. So even, you know, it's not a limit. It's just easier at certain times. I think, like you mentioned, the adolescent brain, so we're looking at primarily 6th grade to 12th grade, I think that's probably the target area with this kind of effort. If you can change how Black females, young Black women at that age group, I think you can probably most quickly change with them. But at any age, you can change a brain. You can change the habits and the culture and the automatic thinking. And a lot of it has to do with automatic thinking. So like reflexive thought, right? So because of your culture and because of things you've consistently experienced, you tend to react certain ways automatically, right? So for example, when, you know, a young Black girl in the world, when they look at music videos, the consistent images of those videos begin to change. It begins to wire certain things in their brain. And primarily, the thing that's wired the most is Black women's value is in their sexual attractiveness. Why? Because that's what I see all the time. How do you change that? Well, this is where it becomes kind of problematic. This is where it becomes difficult. And I'm thinking about what you said about the stripper concept of them being empowered, right? And there's a flaw in that, and I think it's important. If the source of your power is also the source of your dehumanization, are you really empowered? If you can only go to that as your way of being empowered. For example, I'm looking at the cultural effectiveness of music videos. Right. Where primarily you see Black women in these videos being sexualized. Right. Well, you could say, how do we change that? Well, maybe we need more Black female rappers who could come in and change the videos. That makes sense. However, Cardi B, Nicki Minaj, Megan Thee Stallion have not taken that approach, haven't taken that approach, because they've been conditioned by the same culture. So they be, and I'm not attacking them. I'm not at all, but I'm just showing how there's a dilemma here. if they believe that their primary value is in their sexuality and their sexual attractiveness, they're not going to promote they're not going to promote the images to fight that. They're just going to maintain it. The problem is they're not also promoting enough non-sexualized images of power related to Black women. It's pretty much all sexualized. That's problematic. That's how we get stuck in what we're in. I think you mentioned Netflix earlier. You might have not mentioned Netflix, but look at Netflix, right? Netflix created the series on Madam C.J. Walker. I think it was like either a 4 or 6 part, it might have been a 4 part series on Madam C.J. Walker, where they explain her whole life in detail. Like, I appreciated the fact that they didn't rush it, right? Now, there's limitations to this because she's talking about Black women's hair and, you know, that whole color complex. And so I get the limitation that it kind of shows you how big this is, right? Everything we have has some limitation to it. But this, the fact that they showed her as an entrepreneur, showed an anti-sexualized Black female image in an attractive way, right? Look at the movie Hidden Figures, right? Came out a couple years ago. It showed an attractive image that was non-sexualized of Black females doing something to change the world. There's not enough of those images in media to counter the sexualized versions. So maybe part of the change is just figuring out ways to have way more of those images, those non-sexualized images, those alternative images where you can see Black women doing all these different things, not just necessarily being a sexual object. Maybe that's how if we do that enough, it can create positive neuroplasticity, right? So there's maladaptive neuroplasticity that create negative changes in your brain, and then there's positive neuroplasticity. And it's the same concept, it's just in different ways. So if you can show enough positive Black female images of non-sexualized power and effect, then you can slowly begin to change how Black women see themselves, and they won't even realize it's being changed. But it requires people like LeBron James and you know, all these actors who are using their power to promote these images. Like, 5 years ago, we would have never saw Madam C.J. Walker. But it took, I can't think of her name, but she starred as Madam C.J. Walker, but she also co-produced the series along with LeBron James and some other notable Black people. So it took Black people with the resources to start pushing that type of culture that would ultimately change, or has the capacity to change, the brains of younger Black people and older Black people. So again, and I'm trying to say it in a quick way because I know we're running short on time, but your brain can be culturally modified. Culture is one of the main ways you change a person's brain because it's consistent and it's typically emotional, right? So if we can change the culture, it'll produce neuroplasticity. And if we can change the culture positively, it'll produce positive neuroplasticity. So it's a lot to it. But
I love it. I love it. I'm over here dancing. People can't see me because I think it's both and. So I hear what you're saying about the dilemma and the double-edged sword. But as a Black woman, I see both sides. I see what you're saying. And I also see the positive. We need all of these things to be able to reclaim those negative images, because it's not all negative. Black women, we are sexual, and our sexuality is powerful. It does things to people.
It makes people spend a lot of money, do a lot of things, a lot of different things that we're not aware to do.
It does a lot of different things, but there's a harnessing of it. What my issue is that it's been co-opted in a lot of different ways, even to what I think your point here is, even when Black women believe that we are empowered by it, it's still being pimped by something else. That is a problem.
Yeah.
So to your other point, right? We need to put other, we need to populate other non-sexualized, not only demonizing or reducing the sexuality of Black women.
Right.
I don't necessarily support that either, right?
Right.
Because our power, our sexuality is powerful and should not be reduced.
It can be beautiful. Oftentimes, Black female sexuality is simply beautiful, like so attractive, like just beautiful. So I don't want to diminish it either, but I do understand what you're saying, and I don't want to, you know, I'm not anti.
Yes. Sometimes it's co-opted. Right. Right. But we need to know when it's doing what.
Yeah.
So that we're not confused by
it.
And that's the difference. And that's what emerged from that conversation where I was like, wow, okay, yes, it's not just, I mean, I knew it before, but sometimes because I'm looking at it or strongly about it, let's say Nat Turner, Harriet Tubman type of, you know, let's do a do it revolutionarily. Sometimes we might miss, I might miss the need for doing it in different ways or supporting it. And then when I go into the streets and support hip hop feminism and Cardi B and Wet Ass Pussy, I love that song. Yeah, sure, it's problematic, but yes, let's talk about it because at least more people are talking about it. But let's also talk about the additional problems that might be coming out of it too. It's never just binary. There's all shades of gray in there.
Yeah.
I do want to also add to your point about the culture shifting minds and brains. I think that that is so accurate. And I'm seeing it. I don't watch a lot of TV. I'm not plugged into social media in the last couple of decades since it's been out in these ways. But I can see it in movies. And in shows, I recently watched Lovecraft Country. I don't know if you've seen that on
Twitch. Every episode.
Phenomenal. And yes, Misha Green did that. And all the actresses and actors in there. Watchmen, a remake of this Watchmen series. I really appreciated how that ended. And I remember thinking, oh, they're not ready, but I love that ending. I want to be in, if there's a, what do we do? Because that's, okay, God as a Black woman as she walks onto that water. Not to spoil it, people. But there are a lot of things that are happening right now that I know that I'm not aware of. That's part of that cultural shift. Get Out, Jordan Peele, you know, people talking about the terror of racism and what's going on with Black women's bodies, the tarot and womb meditations and divine reclamation in terms of Yemoja or Oshun. I'm just using Yoruba divinity, female principles that I'm familiar with. But that's spread across the diaspora and being reclaimed in a lot of different ways. Wakanda and Black Panther and those, is that the Dahomey warriors that were represented? And you're seeing a lot of the symbolism in that I Am episode of Lovecraft Country. It's not overt, but there are lots of sleeves that are being put out there. And it's not new. It's just being consumed a lot more at this time. So yes, I do believe that there's a reckoning underway in a lot of different ways. Race, gender, and at the intersection of that, we got Black women. We've got some work to do.
Mm-hmm.
And we're gonna do it.
Yep.
I could talk to you forever. I want to stop with this intergenerational thing because the next conversation picks up with an 18-year-old firecracker of a woman who I met through her grandmother. And so this is a nice segue into the continuation of that conversation on the next week. But I might reach out to you for more. I'm curious what people's thoughts are going to be about this episode, questions that are coming up for folks. We talked about a lot of things here. I think we asked more questions and answered things, but that's part of the process. Thank you for your time. I really appreciate
it. No problem. I'm here to serve.
Thank you for joining us today for some Coochie Business. Join us next week for another Coochie Conversation you will not want to miss. Did something on today's show make you go, Let's talk about it. We want to discuss your Coochie questions and share your Coochie stories. And you can submit them to us at questions@coochiebusiness.com for your questions or stories@coochiebusiness.com for your stories. And Coochie is spelled C-O-O-C-H-I-E. and we just might read them on air. Now, you can help Coochie Business grow by helping new listeners find our show. And you can do this by making sure you are subscribed on your podcast platform of choice and by rating the show and leaving a comment with a review. All right, come on, let's get that Coochie Gucci, y'all.